My name is Hillary Draper, and I am an alcoholic. Now, your program didn't get it right, nor did the person that made this thing here get it right. It says there, Father Hillary. You know? My name is Hillary Draper, and I am an alcoholic. And if I ever forget that, the Father won't do me a bit of good. But having said that, I'll say that now you know who I am and what I am. And when the two of us got up this morning, the who said to the what, we ain't going to take a drink today. And it's been that way for many, many days. But it didn't used to be that way. We'd get up and the who would say, we ain't going to take a drink today. And the what would say to the who said so? And the who would say, I said so. And the what would get drunk and the who would have the hangover. Well, before I forget my manners, many thanks to Fred and Martha, to anybody who had anything at all to getting me here. My hosts were delightful people. I didn't have anything to eat coming in from Pensacola. He says, have you had? No, I haven't had anything to eat. Well, we'll stop when we get to Daytona, find a nice restaurant. So he took me to the Shake and Bake. We don't have those in our part of the world. What did I get? I got an orange something. An orange freeze. And it was grand. I had no complaints. I've had no complaints all weekend. Well, there was one. I couldn't get the door to the balcony open. It would slam. And the wind was so ferocious. So, but somebody, I don't know who it was, when I came into my room last night and I had the room locked, that door was open just perfect. And the sea breeze could come in. I didn't open it. I don't know. I don't know who's been in my room. Ray O.K. said he'd get up there and fix it for me. I guess he did. I don't know. Anyhow, it was very pleasant last night. Everything's been grand. I can't get over it. The big book says I'm supposed to stand up here and tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I am like today, not what it. I don't know who it is. I'm going to start off, though, by setting the stage from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got away from Pensacola without my big book, and I've been a nervous wreck until yesterday afternoon. I got to your intergroup office downtown, and there I could buy this book. They didn't give it to me. They sold it to me. Anyhow, here's what it says in chapter 12. Listen now. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. Is that the book? Oh. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. And my story is going to tell you, at least for me, how the terror has turned into acceptance, how the bewilderment has turned into certainty, how the frustration has turned into accomplishment, and how the despair has turned into hope. what I was like. I was born at a very early age in a good Christian home. And I've heard so many alcoholics say that I'm not convinced there's any way as to raise children anymore. But I was in Mobile, Alabama. Now, I just found out that I was in a dysfunctional family. I never knew that. In fact, my sponsor, who is a priest in Pensacola, we were talking, as we generally do, about alcoholics and alcoholism. And he says, well, you were born in a dysfunctional family, no wonder. I says, I was not born in a dysfunctional family. He said, you certainly were. I said, stop the car. I was not born in a dysfunctional family. He said, your father was dead when you were 4 years old. That makes it a dysfunctional family. I never knew that. But that's right. You see, I was in a one-parent family. It was my mother. Now, I did not know that I resented God for many, many years. I didn't know I resented God until I got into AA. But I did. I discovered that I resented God because he had taken my father when I was 4 years old. Thank God I had a wonderful mother and a splendid grandfather who was the male image in my life. But it wasn't the same. My grandfather was not a ball player. It wasn't the same. The other kids had a daddy. I didn't have a daddy. But I didn't know until I got into your program that I resented God. And I did. I just did. Anyhow, in that family, you ask me when I had my first drink. I can't remember. It was always there. Not that we drank every day. We didn't. But when some of the company came, the funny thing was go in the cabinet and get out the joy juice. We didn't call it that then. And everybody had a drink. And the kids, you got a small glass of diluted wine with a lot of cold water. Or you got a very little bit of beer. And you could be just like the big people. I can't remember exactly when I discovered the power of alcohol. I don't really remember that. I think it may have been when I was an altar boy. And you know, they have those little bitty cruets that hold about an ounce and a half, and the priests, most of them, would never finish it. And you were instructed, don't put it back in the wine bottle, it'll sour the rest of the wine. And you don't want to throw it away, you waste it. So what did a smart altar boy do with it? You're right. And I can still remember, I really do. The church was only 3 blocks away from where we lived, our home. And I can remember many days walking on air from the church back home. Now, by the time I got back home, it was reality again. But I remember that. I really do. So, at any rate, if you want to know what I was like, I can tell you in quick. I was a mess. I was just a mess. That's all there is to it. I was the kid who, when they were picking up sides for a game, they'd say, if you take him, we'll give you 2 others. That's true. I just was not well adjusted. That's all there was to that. I was a smart kid. I could get A's, but I never learned how to play baseball until I was in first year college. That's the truth. I did learn I was good at handball. And when I was 15, my mother decided I needed more men in my education, and she sold me up the river to the tender mercies of the Benedictine monks at Cullman, and I never got away. And when I got there, Father Luke, God rest his soul, he was in charge of the younger kids, 15 and under, and he said to me, you go out for basketball. So I went out for basketball. You know, when they cut the team, he says, now you're cut, but he says, if you buy your own uniform, you can still stay out. So I bought my own uniform, and I only played in 1 game. I don't know, the score was astronomically in favor of us, and he says, Draper, go in. I don't know whether I was a forward or a guard, what I was. Anyhow, They threw me the ball, and I knew how to dribble it, and I dribbled it down the court and made 2 points for the opposing team. Father Luke jumped up and threw his hat down and stomped on the floor, and he got me out of that game. I never got back in another game. Dear, dear Lord. Well, so that's what I was like. Now, when I was 18 years old, I had come to love everything there was about Coleman, St. Bernard. The monks, the people in town. I had come to make friends with some of the boys' families who weren't boarders, and I got into there. And those people in that time, that was the late 30s, all the housewives with the name in Coleman, Alabama, knew how to squeeze the grape and make that German-type grape juice. Only they did it with Coleman County strawberries. And if you all never tasted Coleman County strawberry wine before you got into AA, it's just too late. You'll have to wait till you go to heaven. I mean, the most gorgeous color of red you ever saw in a bottle. And when you took the cork out, you could smell it in the next block. And it had a kick like a proverbial Missouri mule. But you were in no trouble. You had a small glass of homemade wine, a piece of cake. But when I asked if I could join the monks, they said I could try. And in 1941, that's a long time ago, I took the veil. And I joined the monastery. They said I could try. And when I got in, they let me in on the secrets. And one of the secrets was that the monks were not about to be outdone by the wives of Coleman County people. And they, too, knew how to squeeze the grape and make that German-type grape juice. And they made a little home brew on the side. Now, you talk about a revelation to the Gentiles. Now, the monks didn't drink every day. They certainly did not. But on big feast days, they'd come together for an hour after Vespers and ham sandwiches and cheese and homemade wine and beer and pink lemonade for the panty waists, you know. But I found then, there I'm 18, 19 years old, that it meant more to me. I was always the first one there and the last one to leave. I was always figuring out, when is this going to happen again, you know. Couldn't wait. And from that age, I had established my drinking habits. I always drank as much as I could, as often as I could, as long as I could. I never quite quit drinking unless one of two things happened. Unless there wasn't anything left to drink, or I was too sick to drink it, period. And that's not normal drinking. I should have known that. But let me show you what happened. Here I am in the monastery, a novice, supposed to be pursuing God. You don't join a monastery to become a drunk. But we're having a Christmas party. And everybody's having a great time. You know. The only thing is, I say the party started about 8:30 and it was over by 11 o'clock. But about 9:30, I went into a blackout. And I don't remember a thing, not a thing, until the next morning when I got up to go to prayers. Do I have to tell you what a blackout is? They talked about it, but nobody explained what it is. I'll tell you, so you'll be sure you know it. You drink and drink and drink and drink and drink. And you go unconscious and you slide under the table. And you stay there until somebody carries you home, or the next morning comes and you realize where you are. That is not blacking out. That's passing out. And I've passed out too. But blacking out, you drink and drink and drink and drink and drink. And the body, in order to save its own life, short-circuits some of the systems, and you go into temporary amnesia. You don't remember anything. You continue to function, quote, normally, quote, but you don't remember it. Well, I often think about these dear Al-Anons who say to their husbands, "Where were you last night?" He says, "I don't remember." She says, "You're lying. Who were you with?" "I don't know." Lying again. He may not be lying at all. He may not have the slightest idea where he was or who he was with. And you know, the reason I tell you that is here I am at 18, 19 years old, I'm experiencing a blackout. And that is almost a Satan sign that you got it. Period. If you've experienced blackouts and you're over in the Al-Anon room, you probably ought to move your letter over to our room. We get a lot of Al-Anons that way. Some of the best. Anyhow, there it is. Now, when I get up the next morning, I sneak around and try to find out what happened. I don't remember. And they tell me, and nothing. I stayed till the last shot was fired. Crazy as ever, helped do the dishes, helped the old father to the room, said my prayers, went to bed. But you know, being an intelligent kid, I had to explain this to myself. I wouldn't ask anybody about it. God forbid. But in my own mind, considering with Aristotelian Thomistic philosophical principles, I came to the conclusion that it was the cheese. Now, you can laugh all you want, but that makes a great deal of sense to this alcoholic at that time. And I've been afraid of cheese ever since. Went out last night and I said, you want blue cheese dressing? No. Wouldn't touch it. Wouldn't touch it. But there I am. I've crossed that invisible line between controlled and uncontrolled drinking. And I often think if I could have talked to somebody like you all, and they could have said to me, hey, kid, what you've just described is a Satan sign that you are afflicted with the disease of alcoholism, and you're never going to be able to handle alcohol. You better quit while you can. I don't know. But that's water over the dam and under the bridge. Nothing I can do about it. So what happened is, it's a progressive disease. I found that out after I came to you all, that it's a mental obsession tied up with a physical compulsion to drink. When everything else says you shouldn't, the alcoholic says, I'm gonna. Period. Lord have mercy. 1947, I was called to orders. I was ordained. And believe me, if there had been any overt signs of alcoholism at that time, Archbishop Tulin would not have called me to orders. The Catholic Church has got enough trouble without ordaining drunk monks. But at any rate, I did get ordained. And the opportunities for drinking are more frequent. And the pattern is there. I drink as often as I can, as long as I can. If I can't find any more, I can't drink it, but I'll drink. Till there's nothing left or I can't drink any more. And you see, what happens then, I'm teaching 5 classes a day. I'm associate principal in a fancy prep school. And the boss knows I'm drinking too much, but he doesn't say one word to me. If he had said a word to me about my drinking, I'd have been on him like a bee on a bulldog. I'd have said, what you talking to me about drinking too much? Why don't you get on some of these bums over here that are not doing a thing? I'm teaching 5 classes a day. I'm running this school. If I am drinking too much, it's only me that's being affected, which was a lie. You know, I could have been a much better administrator, a much better professor if I didn't have to drink. But he didn't say that to me. What I got was a geographical cure removal before I knew what that was. The boss and I weren't talking at that time. I was at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa in pursuit of an elusive degree, and I got this letter. And it says, I want you to go to Barberville, Kentucky. We need Father Timothy to come home and teach philosophy. Please get there by September the 15th. I didn't think they could run that school without me. And I didn't join the Benedictines to run a parish. I was going to stay in the monastery. But here are the orders. Go. Oh, I was furious. Talk about a resentment. I took that letter to a friend of mine, a priest. We were both at the university, and I gave it to him. And he laughed. He just laughed uproar. I said, what are you laughing about? Oh, he says, I'm just laughing. I said, do you know where Barberville, Kentucky is? He says, yes. You go to hell, turn left, and walk 3 miles. He was wrong. It was only 2 miles. I was so loaded with resentments, I didn't even tell the boss goodbye. And the rules are that you're supposed to ask the boss for a blessing before you leave the premises. I wouldn't even talk to him. I packed up those things, put them in the wagon, and off I went to the mountains. I'm telling you. Bobbaville, Kentucky, 1950-something. You see, I was ordained in 47. For 5 years, you're what they call junior clergy. Before I ended up being a junior clergy, I was in the mountains of Kentucky, which is unheard of. I mean, they didn't do that to junior clergy. You weren't smart enough. But he couldn't stand me, and he was getting rid of me. That's all there was to it. Oh, Lord have mercy. And I went to Bobbaville, Kentucky. You should have seen Bobbaville, Kentucky in the 1950s. They've improved a great deal since then. But, oh, Lord have mercy. And the Father Timothy, I'll tell you that real quick. The first morning we were there, he said, we had said Mass, and he said, you take your meals when you're here over at Aunt Sally Coon's house, which is next door. So we go over to Aunt Sally Coon's house, a four-room miner's cabin, and there's Aunt Sally Coon. She looked like nothing so much as Mammy Yoakum. You remember Mammy Yoakum in the funny face with a pipe in her mouth? Oh. Uncle Albert Coon was a retired miner. He was a Catholic. She was a member of the Lottie Moon Cycle. He was a lovely man. She was a nice lady. He sat there. Down here sat his son, who was a state trooper, and two of his sons. None of them had anything on except a pair of shorts. There was Father Timothy. Here I am. And he's sitting in front of me. His conversation's difficult, you know. There's this water tumbling. Cold. Beads running down it. And I picked up that water glass, and I took two great big swallows. Well, you've seen the atomic bomb blast. I mean, my head just went right straight off. My hair stood straight up, the back of my neck. I couldn't see anything. I couldn't hear. If I hadn't been an alcoholic, I would have screamed bloody murder. But what I do is hang on tight till the tremors pass. Now, I'm telling you the truth. And when that breakfast was over and Timothy and I were stepping high over the weeds going back to the church, I said to him, in the Lord's holy name, what was in that water glass? He said, moonshine, 120 proof. I said, for breakfast? He says, anytime you can get it. Wasn't that a glorious place to send a budding alcoholic? And I bloomed. And it was there that I met AA for the first time. Father Timothy said, he's gone to heaven. He joined the going to a little late. But anyhow, he said to me, you know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, well, they do something for poor people who drink too much. He said, well, there's a group that's just been founded here. None of your members, church members, belong. But some of the spouses do, and I've been going to try to help them. He said, you might want to go. I said, yeah, I'll go down and help him. I'll do anything. So I go to the AA. About 6 or 8 or 7 men there, lovely, lovely people. They won't let me come to the closed meetings. I thought to myself, if they let me come to the closed meetings, I could probably help the devils, you know. But I'm convinced today that the subject of their closed meetings often was, what are we going to do with that young priest at the end of Pine Street? Who looks like a duck, who walks like a duck, who smells like a duck, who quacks like a duck, and doesn't know he's a duck. Let me tell you to what extremes they went to try to help me. There was a gathering like this at Cumberland Falls State Park, southeastern Kentucky. And I was invited to be the Sunday morning speaker as a friend of AA. When I tell you that, I can almost spit up on the podium right here. I mean, you talk about the towering ego and the pride. I spoke to those marvelous people, and I looked down on them. And I told them I was not an alcoholic, but that if ever I was in need of their program, I would be happy to be associated with people like them. So one of the whole audience didn't vomit. And I can just hear what they said to the speakers panel. Dear, dear God. And that was to come home to roost, as you will hear. I didn't quit drinking. I was recalled to the Abbey to work in the school By this time, I'm hooked. I got to have it. I don't have to drink every time. But I got to have it in the closet where I can shake it and look at the frog eyes. You know. Anybody else look at the frog eyes? And the pattern was established. Once I opened the bottle, I didn't quit. I was gone. Period. But as I say, I didn't have to do it every day at that time. But what happens is, in 3 years, the terrible clashes are arising between me and the boss. Even though I live in the same building with him, we're not talking. Does that ring a bell with some of y'all? Tell him so-and-so. You tell him so-and-so. This time I get a letter slipped under my door, and it says, we need you to go over to Shaw, Mississippi, and report over there at such and such a date. Once again, now by this time he knows that I'm seriously into drinking, but again he does not face me down. I get a second geographical cure removal. But this time to the delta of the Mississippi. Now if you all think the delta begins south of New Orleans, you are mistaken. The delta of the Mississippi begins in the lobby of the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee, and it goes downriver, 40 miles on the Mississippi side, 20 miles on the Arkansas side, till you come to Yazoo City. And if you all haven't been in that part of the South, you don't know what the South is all about. Those people do not know that the Civil War was lost. They don't even know it was fought and couldn't care less. You talk about drinking as a way of life. Lord have mercy on my poor soul. What a place to send me. Now I'm a fully bloomed alcoholic. It was a 99 9/10 Italian. And I never in my life ever served in a parish where here would come Uncle Pino Camperoni to see me after breakfast about something. And I'd get done what he wanted, but he wouldn't leave. And I would say, Pino, I've got to go downtown. You have to leave now. Oh, well, he says, they always offered me a drink before I left. I said, they did? He said, yeah. I said, well, let's have a drink. You know, I never saw it just wide open like that in a priest's house. You close the doors. And it was the same when you went to see them. You never left without a drink. Oh, I'd come to heaven. You know? Absolutely unbelievable. I could call up and Mamie, and she'd say, hello. I say, Mamie? She'd say, yeah, Father, be there in just a minute. And she'd bring in the new soldiers and take the dead ones out. You talk about service. I never got such service in my life. But, of course, I'm an alcoholic. I've got the disease of alcoholism, and it's progressive, which means it gets worse. It doesn't get better. And it destroys the total human personality. It takes, first of all, the spirit, the soul, the spirit. It takes the mind. It takes the emotions. Finally, it takes the body. You can't walk anymore. And I was coming apart. I was coming apart at the seams. Lord have mercy. You know, and you think nobody knows. Ha ha! They all know. Oh, mercy. They used to give me Christmas presents. What are you going to give a priest for Christmas? If he drinks, you know what you're going to give him. And I'd get these beautiful bottles all wrapped up in Christmas stuff. But long before Christmas, I put them under the tree. I'd run out of whiskey. So what would I do? They were mine, but no, I'd get a knife and cut the bottom out of them very carefully and get the bottle out and seal the package back up and put it under the tree. Does that make sense to you? But you see, people were beginning to talk ugly about me. You know, terrible. We had a new boss at Coleman. It was a Yankee from Minnesota come down to save our lives. God bless us. He did save my life, and I love him today. He's retired and 90 years old at Coleman. I write him every Christmas to thank him for saving my life. But I didn't like him then. I got a letter from him. He's coming over to Little Rock, and he's going to stop with me overnight. And I thought, somebody's been talking. And he comes with his aide-de-camp, and we have a supper. We have antipasta. We have pasta. We have drinks before, drinks with, drinks after. I don't touch a thing. The man goes to bed, and I say to his aide-de-camp, what's the boss want over here? He said, didn't he talk to you? I said, well, he didn't say anything more than you heard. Well, he said, you've been nominated as the 7th president of St. Bernard College. And he, as the chairman of the board, said he needed to interview you before he acted on that nomination. And he told me, as he was undressing tonight, that he was well satisfied and he's going to accept the nomination. And I got the bid to be 7th president of St. Bernard College. Now, by this time, I realize there's something wrong with me. And being offered that kind of job, a sane person would have said, thank you, I cannot do it. But what does the towering ego of the alcoholic say? Of course I'll take that job. You don't think you'd be offering it to a drunk? That'll show these people whether I've got a problem or not. And I know today they gave me a glorious send-off, but they were saying, thank God he's gone. Once again, because of this program, I've been able to make amends and to hold my head up again in Shaw, Mississippi. But I came home to be president of the college for 3 years, and I got news for you. If you want to be a practicing alcoholic, get to be president of a college. You don't have to go looking for it. It's there, morning, noon, and night. The only trouble is that everything that happens, almost everything that happens to alcoholics, to drunks, happened to me in those 3 years. Yeah, absolutely. I ended up in jail. Can you imagine that? I've only been to jail one time in my life, and I never want to go again. I woke up in jail, and I looked up, and there were bars at the windows, and I was sleeping on a bed with no mattress, just the springs. And I thought, where am I? And it dawned on me, you in jail. Dear God, how did I get here? And I got up to look out the window, and I resented the hell out of the people who built that jail, because I could not tell whether I was in Memphis, Birmingham, Mobile, Montgomery, Nashville, or Rome, Italy. And I didn't know how I got there. I was in a small Alabama town, and in small Alabama towns, there's always somebody who is Mr. and Mrs. Catholic Church. So they called Mr. Catholic Church, and they said, we got a priest down here in the jail. What you want to do with him? And Mr. Catholic Church says, who is it? Says, well, his driver's license says Hillary B. Draper, Coleman, Alabama. Oh, he says, just leave him there. I'll get him in the morning. I'm sure there's some of you who remember the first time you had to walk down in front of the sergeant at the desk. And there was Mr. Catholic Church, Mr. Frank, ready to get me. And I want you to know that I'd have rather seen the Pope that morning than seen him. And I'll tell you why, because he turned out to be the chairman of the lay board of governors of the college of which I was a hotshot president. Talk about coincidence. And you know I conned that man. He was a beautiful man. He's gone to heaven now. He never was an alcoholic. He said to me, Father Hillary, we got to do something about this. I said, oh, Frank, I was at the country club and I just had too much cheese. And you know I conned him. He should have taken me right straight to the bishop and the abbot and said, we got a problem here. You're going to have to do something with it. But no, he's an enabler. He does not. And they give me one more chance. That one more chance lasted one more year. And then I really blew it. The president of the college was to make a State of the Union message. before all the important people in the college, the monks, the lay teachers, the board of trustees, the board of governors, the student governor association, and I made that speech. It was after dinner, about 8 o'clock at night, but the last thing I remember was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, taking one more drink to steady my nerves. And I went into a blackout, and I gave that report in a blackout. When I tell you that, I can really begin to perspire, to sweat, and to shake, because I can have some idea of what it must have been like for those lovely peoples to sit there and watch and listen to their obviously drunken president of the college. That was my bottom. When I came to on the next day at 6 o'clock in the morning, I noticed the atmosphere on the campus was a little cool. I had figuratively slit my throat from ear to ear. 3 days later, I'm in the abbot's office, the chancellor's office, throwing dust, you know how we do, so you don't see what's going on. And he listened, and then he said, "Sit down, I want to say something to you." And I sat down, and I should have known something was happening. You don't sit down in his office unless there's something really, really. He says, "We had a meeting of the board of trustees yesterday." I said, "You did? You didn't notify me. I've got myself elected to the board." See? He said, "No, but we had a quorum. Me and Bold Brassy." I said, "What was on the agenda?" He says, "Only one thing, namely your resignation." That was in December. I said, "When is it effective?" "In June?" He said, "No, it's effective as of this date. We've drawn it up. Please sign here." And then he proceeded to read me the riot act in 7 gorgeous technicolor scenes. He told me that I had disgraced my own good name, that I was a disgrace to the priesthood, that I had dragged the good name of the college through the mud. I mean, it was awful, just terrible. And he ended up and he said, "You've got 2 alternatives. You can either go somewheres and get some help with your drinking." Now, he doesn't know the word alcohol or alcoholism. "You can go somewheres and get some help with your drinking problem, or you can get the hell out of here. We're not putting up with this anymore. We've had enough. I'll help you get a job in any college in the country. You're a good teacher, but you cannot stay here. You cannot stay here." I don't know whether I can make you realize what that was for me. The 2 things I loved the most, and still do, was my priesthood and St. Bernard Cullman. And when he was talking to me, I thought I had lost them both. And I said, "Yes, I'll go anywheres and do anything to get some help with my drinking problem." I did not know for a long time what let me say yes, because I am convinced that if I had said no, I'd be dead today or locked up in an insane asylum. I couldn't have stood it. But I said yes. And let me tell you how horrible that was. Now, just having lost everything that meant anything to me, you know what I did? I went right downstairs and had another drink to steady my nerve. Does that make any sense? For an alcoholic, yes, but for a sane person, it doesn't make any sense. Dear Lord in heaven. And so, my dry date is January the 14th, 1968, because that's when I got sent to Hazelden. He was from Minnesota, and he had heard that Hazelden had a reputation for doing good for people who were bad to drink. I went to Hazelden. It was in January. Have you ever been in Minnesota in January? Woo! I came out of Birmingham, Alabama on the train, and the temperature was 65, and when I got to Minneapolis, it was 20 degrees below. No wonder those people drank. But I don't know about you. I'm convinced that I needed what I got, that I don't think I could have gotten sober unless I had been locked up. I really don't. And I know that there are establishments that dry you out, introduce you to the pills, and turn you loose to run again. But Hazelden wasn't that. They worked on the 12 steps. They did it in 21 days. Can you imagine? But I was a slow learner. they did the first five steps, and you couldn't get out of there until you did the first five steps. The first morning I was there, they took me down to see a counselor who was a truck driver. And the first thing he said to me, "Now, we're not going to call you Father Hillary any longer. You're not in good standing. Take off that collar." There I was sitting there with my black dickie on and my white collar. Butter wouldn't melt in my mouth. He says, "Take it off." And he says, "Secondly, don't plan on 3 weeks to get this program." I said, "No, I reckon I'll get it in 2. He said, "Oh, no, no, no." He said, "We find for doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, undertakers, pharmacists, college professors, ministers, takes 3 and 4 times as long to get this simple program." I said, "Why?" They said, "Because you all keep up such a dreadful front. It takes a long time to get behind there and find out where the real Hillary is living." And they were right. I told you, I went to Hazel on January 14th. 40 days of Lent came and went. 40 days of Easter came and went. May crowning came and went. Graduation came and went. That first day, they had sold me this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they'd said, "Read it." And the first thing I did when I got back to my cell was to look inside to see if it was approved by a bishop in the Catholic Church. And as you know, it isn't. And I concluded that it was printed by the Baptists in Nashville. And they went about to brainwash me. And I wouldn't read the big book. Now, they sold me the little 24-hour day book. That wasn't approved by a bishop, but I loved it. I read it every day, but I would not read that big book. No. Now, I had to go to 3 meetings a day, in the morning, the afternoon, and the evening, and they had little meetings where they tried to get you to face yourself, and all they talked about was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was there so long I could give the lectures. But it finally became apparent to me that if I didn't read that big book, I was going to be there till Gabriel blew his horn. And I didn't want to be there that long. That's the truth. And one night I sat up and read the first 164 pages. And the next morning I'm down to that truck driver counselor. And I said, "I've got step one. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable." He says, "You ain't got nothing. Get back." I said, "I've got step one." He says, "You are loaded with resentments." I said, "I don't resent anybody." And you know, he was right. I resented everybody at that time. I resented God, I told you that. I resented the bishop, I resented the abbot, I resented all the monks at Cullman. I resented everybody. But the Lord works in strange ways his wonders to accomplish. There was a little bit of a creature there. He was a religious brother. And we could go to Mass every morning if we were recovering. And he would go, but he wouldn't say Mass with the rest of us. He'd go separate. And one Sunday afternoon, there's a knock at my cell door, and I said, "Come in." And in comes this little creature. And I said, "What you want?" He says, "Well, they told me," he said, "first of all, I'm what they call a golden slipper. I took this program, and I went home, and I got drunk the night I got home. And the next day, they put me in again." So he said, "I'm a golden slipper." And he said, the counselors, when they review the patients every week, have concluded that my self-esteem is so low, my self-worth is so negative, that I could go through a closed door walking underneath it. You were so far up in the clouds that if they couldn't get you down, you'd never get the program. So they told me to come see you to see if you could get me up and I could get you down. Now, I'm paying good money for this. I said, "They told you what?" I said, "Did they tell you how to do it?" He says, "No." But he looked so woebegone. I said, "Well, sit down." He sat down, and I said, "What's your name?" He said, "I'm Brother Joel. He's dead." I said, "I'm Father Hillary." I said, "What kind of brother are you?" He said, "I'm a Christian brother, the schools." Well, I knew the Christian Brothers from Memphis. We beat them in basketball every year. He said, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Alabama, Coleman, St. Bernard." I said, "What were you in the college?" He said, "I was the president." He said, "What were you?" I said, "I was the president." And you know, he had two PhDs and one of them in Greek. And his student body was three times as big as mine. And I had thought nobody as important as me ever came down the pike of alcoholism. And here was Brother Joel. Well, man, we identified, I'm telling you, both of us. That was the day that we really began our recovery. We really did. It was a real success story. He never got to be president of the college again. He was the head brother. I never got to be president of the college again. I turned out to be the abbot. And when he was celebrating his golden jubilee, he invited me to come up. He was at someplace there in Minnesota, St. Teresa's College. I don't know where it is, but it's up there somewhere. And he invited me to come up and preach for his golden jubilee. Well, man, I went up there. And by that time, I've got this pointy hat that the bishops wear, and I've got that gold stick, and I got the red ribbons and the lace, and I put on everything I got, and I go up there to preach that sermon. And there were any number of bishops there, and they were saying at the table, "How does Brother Joel know the abbot of Alabama so well as to invite him to come up here?" And I looked at Brother Joel. Joel looked at me. I said, "Bishop, ain't neither one of us going to tell you." But finally, they asked me where they wanted the body sent. And I said, "Oh, I don't know. I don't think they'll let me go back to Coleman." He said, "You got to go back to Coleman." He said, "You got to go back and pick up the pieces." I said, "Well, you convince the Board of Trustees to let me come back, and I'll come back." And he did, and they did, and I did. I couldn't say it was a happy homecoming. It wasn't. The abbot then said to me, "What are you supposed to do?" I said, "Well, I'm supposed to go to some kind of meetings, but they don't have them in Coleman." He said, "Well, you could go up to Decatur. That's only 30 miles. I said, "I don't really need them. I got this big book, and I share my experience, strength, and hope with people I think will do them some good." And for 3 months, I stayed a loner. It's a wonder I didn't get back in the bottle. Really, really. And this Father Luke, God bless him and rest his soul, he was not an alcoholic, but he would say to me, "Aren't you supposed to be going to some kind of meetings or something?" I said, "Yeah, but they don't have him coming." After about 3 weeks, he walked up to me and handed me a piece of paper. He said, "For your information, AA is alive and well in Coleman. Call this number." Every day he'd say to me, "You call?" I said, "Yeah, they don't answer." Finally he said to me, "When do you call?" I said, "Midnight." And they didn't have an answering service. And that's true. I'm not making that up. He says, "Pick up the telephone, call right now." And I did, and I got my first Coleman sponsor, Juby, who was a used car salesman. And a redneck of the first order. And I said, "Mr. G, this is Father Hillary at the college. I need to go to an AA meeting." There was this long pause, and the first thing he ever said to me, notice please, he's a real recovering alcoholic, "Father, are you drinking now?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, don't take a drink. I'll be out there about 7:30 to pick you up. We have an 8:00 meeting." I said, "Well, that's fine, Mr. G, but don't come to the front door of the college. I'll meet you down on the road to the cemetery under the pine trees in the moonlight." I'm telling you the truth, and if you come to Coleman, I'll show you the road to the cemetery and the bushes that I crawled out from to get into the car. Unbelievable, you know. Somebody in Juby didn't say to me, Father, when you want what we've got, we'll go to any lengths to get it, call me back. But he doesn't. He comes and gets me out from the bushes and takes me to the meeting in Cullman, Alabama. I wish I could tell you I went up the steps and it was glory hallelujah. It wasn't. It was just a little old bitty room about as big as that tape deal over there, and had a naked light bulb hanging down from the middle, and the wallpaper was coming off the walls. There was a hole where they swept the date down on the man next door. An old sofa there, and about eight people, and they all looked to me like they were foot-washing Baptists at Church of Christ. And I thought, dear God, am I being condemned to spend my life here? Oh. Now, that's the way it was. I'm looking through that glass door, and I'd have gone back, but it was cold, January again, 2 miles back to the college, and, you know, a good sponsor knows when to disappear. And I couldn't find Juby. So I'm standing at that door. I'm telling you the truth, and I'm just having all these terrible thoughts, and a lady comes up and takes me by the arm. She says, hello, Father Hillary. She's a gorgeous woman from Decatur, a Catholic. I did not know she was in AA. I'd been working with her on several projects in the church. And what had happened, I didn't know it was a put-up job. She put her arm through mine. She said, come on in, have a cup of coffee. You're going to be all right. And she mesmerized me right through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never got away. But I did not know for 2 years, or maybe three, that that was all a put-up job, that she was a shill. Then when I called Juby, he called Decatur, and he says, Rosemary, get down here. I need you to help me. I got a new man coming in tonight. She says, I can. I'm chairing my own meeting. He says, get somebody else to chair. This is a Catholic priest. I don't know a damn thing about Catholics, much less priests. You're a Catholic. Get down here and help me with him. Read the big book. You know, how to talk to the new man. I just get goosebumps when I think that if Rosemary had been there that night, I probably would have walked away again. But Rosemary was there, and we went to the meeting. Rosemary's dead and gone now, but you can believe me that we have established a relationship that was just unbelievable. What a wonderful, wonderful woman. And there weren't many ladies in AA at that time. Rosemary. That was the beginning. That's going to tell you now. See, I've told you what I was like. What happened? You're going to get what I'm like now. Period. The first meeting I went to, they only had one meeting a week, and they announced that some of them felt the need for a closed meeting, discussion meeting, and therefore the next Friday they'd start that. And now listen, this is my first meeting, and I speak up. And I say, that's grand, because I don't like the speaker meetings anyway, and one meeting a week will just do fine for me. Now, the old members of that group said, if he only goes to one meeting a week, he's going to be drunk in short order. So they started a campaign, get Hillary to the meetings. I told you we only had one meeting a week, but they would announce, if you feel the need for a meeting any day in the week, just be down here in front of the pool room at 7:30, and a call come up, and you can get in and go to a meeting. Well, you know, it was like the mafia. These big black cars would swing up, and they'd open the door, and you'd jump in, and they'd close the door, and away they'd go. God knows where they were going. I didn't know where they were going. Wonderful, wonderful. I remember one night, as I told you, Juby was a car salesman, and he had this great big Lincoln Continental, and I was in the front with him and another member, and in the back there were three people, but there was a husband and wife. He was in jail. But see, we had things so well established in Cullman, we could take him out of jail and take him to a meeting and bring him back to jail. And I would say to the judge, I'm afraid we'll lose some of them. He says, well, there's a lot of rabbit in all of you all, but we'll catch him. Anyhow, we're going down to this meeting in Birmingham, and the conversation lags, and then there's this little bitty voice from the back, Evelyn. She says, well, as I says to Billy, Billy, look what we've drinked ourselves into. High-class society and a great big automobile. I'm dumbfounded. I can't answer that. But Juby says, Thank you, Evelyn, but really it ain't nothing but a car full of drunks. And you know, they were right. They were right. Dear, dear God, that has grown in Cullman to where there are at least four separate groups and a meeting every night and every day at noon in Cullman, Alabama. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And I'm going back to Cullman, as you may know. Anyhow, that was the beginning, and the beginning of the growing. I had done the first five steps. But the growth steps, as Ray told us, you got to go through 6, 7, 8, and 9. Ted. And I had good sponsors. They took me through those steps. And they told me certain things. They said, if you ask an alcoholic three questions. Number one, what's your home group? Number two, what step are you working on now? I forget the third question. But the first two will be enough. It wouldn't come to me. He says, if they say, well, I use everybody as a home group, and I work on all the steps. He said, you know, he's not really a practicing recovering alcoholic. That you got to have a home group or sponsor. Who your sponsor is. You got to have a sponsor. And you got to know what step you're working on. The step that I'm working on these days is that one that says sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with the God whom I choose to call higher power, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it out. That's the one I'm working on. That's the one I'm working on. Well, I got back to the college. I did not get to be college president. I told you that. When I got back, the boss man said, go over there and ask them if they'll let you teach. And I went over there in the education department, and the chairman of the education department was a redneck that I had gotten out of the woods in central Alabama and got educated. And he's now the chairman of the department with a PhD. And I asked him, can I teach? He says, I'll think about it. He sends me a letter. He says, if I can stay sober, I can teach two sections of philosophy of education. I was so mad with him, I almost got drunk at him. Imagine. I mean, I wasn't an adjunct professor. I was just a visiting lecturer. That's where it started. But because of AA, it was grand. Never complained. Just so glad to get back in. 1972, the old abbot retired and the monks got together to elect a new head honcho. They do that by praying. They don't do any log rolling. They have a nomination ballot where you can put down any name of any monk who you think would make a good abbot. And my name was on the nomination list. And I thought, oh, Lord have mercy, because let me tell you what to do with that. When they get that list, they say, call it a name on the list, Father Hillary will please leave the election hall. And you go out, and then the boss says, what do you know about Father Hillary that in your opinion will make him a good abbot, or in your opinion will make him a bad abbot? And then they start out with the junior, and you have to stand up. And I've been in those things. And you get people who stand and say, well, I heard, and they'll slam the gavel down and say, we're not a bit interested in what you heard. Tell us what you know. And if you don't know anything, sit down. At any rate, to make the long story short, the election is accomplished the next day. They have the examinations the night before. And when the election was complete, the seventh abbot of St. Bernard Abbey turned out to be Father Hillary. I don't like to tell you that, but my sponsor says it happened and you tell it. You tell it because what it says to the alcoholic is you get in AA and you stay in AA and there's nowhere you can't go. There's nowhere you can't go. Well, you have to sign all these documents and they ring the bells and the young monks who can't vote are waiting to hear who's elected and they say, Father Hillary. They're running through the halls of the monastery shouting all the way with AA. And for 15 years, I was the head honcho. I never needed AA as much as I did at that time. I couldn't have done the job without Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God, the monks were understanding enough that if I needed to go to a meeting, so many wonderful things happened. Oh, dear Lord. I don't know. Let me see what the time is. It's 20 minutes to 11. Is that right? And I started talking when? 9:30? No, I didn't get started. Had to listen to those jokes. But there's a man sitting here who came to see me. I had been over to the Naval Air Station at Jacksonville reviewing their recovery program for them. Can you imagine that? I got to be an expert. And anyhow, the AAs had an affair, and I went to speak at that, and afterwards they stayed for coffee and donuts. And the next morning, the man who's sitting here called me up, and he said, "Do you know who Joe Blow is?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you were talking to him last night, and he's the biggest account executive that Merrill Lynch ever had." And he said, "You were bad-mouthing Merrill Lynch. And I'm in charge of Merrill Lynch over here, and he told me to get over here and find out why you don't like Merrill Lynch." I said, "Well, I'm sorry. I probably wouldn't have said it if I'd known who he was, but I don't change my opinion." And I told him why I didn't like it. And he said to me, "Well, when you go home, send your accounts over to me at Jacksonville Beach." I said, "Jacksonville Beach?" He says, "I got an 800 number. Birmingham doesn't have it, so I got everything up." And I said to the treasurer, "Go through the office and whatever we've got in stocks and bonds. We'll send the whole thing over to them in Jacksonville Beach." And I did. And a day or two later, I got a telephone call from that man. He's sitting right over there, and he said to me, "Father Hillary, do you know how much money you've got?" I said, "No, I don't know." He said, "Well, you've got too much for us to trade across the counter. You need an executive accountant." I says, "What's that?" He said, "Somebody to manage your money." "Oh." I says, "Well, who will I get?" He says, "Well, we'll do it." I said, "I don't know a thing about it." So they sent a group over to tell us monks how to invest our money. That was in the 70s, as I said, and we hit the market just at the right time. Now, you won't believe this, but at that time, he said to me, "If we can't make 15%, you don't need us." "Oh, all right." He said, "What do you want?" I said, "We want to make as much money as we can, as fast as we can, as easy as we can, with no risk." He says, "That's not possible." But at any rate, they did take our account over. And I'm not telling the truth, I'm trying to. I believe for the next 10 years, we averaged something like 25% return on our investment. Now, we went from nothing. I mean, when I became abbot, we owed everybody in the world. In 15 years, because of my connections in AA through Merrill Lynch, I left them with a big money. We didn't have to spend it. I just let it turn over. And when you do that, the money grows. Oh, it puddles. But all these great things came to me through Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one of the biggest. Now, they're still with those people. They're not making as much money as they did when I was in charge. But it was great. I'll tell you this story, and then I'll shut up. I must have been 1970. I forget when it was. But anyhow, I had an opportunity to go to the Holy Land, to walk in the footsteps of Jesus. And I went, and it was a VIP tour, 15 of us, bishops and abbots and monsignors, you know. And everywhere as we went, all I could do was weep. All I could do was absolutely just sit down and cry. And the bishops would say, "Father Hillary, what's the matter with you? Stop all that crying." And I would say, "Just get away. Alcoholics Anonymous told me that if I wanted to cry, I could certainly cry." And I don't know whether it was the gift of tears, a medieval gift, or whether it was me trying to make amends for all the times when I should not have been functioning as a priest because of my alcoholism. I don't know. But it was a glorious experience for me. I know that. We went everywhere in the Holy Land, but the thing that impressed me the most was the home of Martha and Mary and Lazarus. You remember those, Creed? And Lazarus has died, and Christ isn't there. and Martha's as mad as a hot as a Saturday night pistol. There, this hotshot rabbi has been doing so much for everybody, doesn't do a thing for them. He's not even there when Lazarus dies. He comes along about 4 days afterwards. She runs out to confront him, and she says, "If thou hadst been here, my brother had not died." Poor Martha, she's facing almighty power. It's the one that she almost tore the sheet, but she's also facing infinite mercy and understanding. And the Lord says to her, "Martha, thy brother will rise again." And all of a sudden, Martha is changed from her personality. And she says, I know. At the last day. He says, "Let me go see where you've buried him." When they get out to the cemetery, he says, "Roll back the door of the stone over the tomb." And Martha says, "He's been there 4 days. By this time, he stinks." My dear friends in AA, I know that I stank. But I also know what Lazarus felt like when he walked out of that tomb. Thank you for listening to me.